Good afternoon, everyone. It is about 3:10 on April 2nd, and in this time and place, I will call to order the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. With apologies, we're starting a few minutes behind because the folks that were occupying this room just were having so much fun that that we couldn't get them out of here. But, and that being said, I'm going to call to I'm going to convene a public hearing on House Bill 5012. We do have some new information that we want to cover today, but Director, from yesterday, we had some kind of lingering questions that we didn't get into in full detail. Senator Johnson?
I did. Thank you for your courtesy, Mr. Chair. This is one of these things that you go home after the hearing and you're sort of mulling over what happened, and it crystallized for me, but not while I was still here. I very much would like to revisit, if it's okay, with Mr. Long, a couple of questions that I have about building codes.
Certainly.
If that's okay. And I appreciate him coming over. When you gave your testimony, well, I guess you need to welcome him or get him on the record, whatever it is you're doing.
We're delighted to see you back. And could you introduce yourselves for the record, and we'll go from there?
Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes.
Cool. Okay. So now to the question. Yesterday in your presentation, you talked very optimistically about some of the things that e-permitting was going to do. And it was good news and welcome news that you were expanding a service that I think is a good thing. But you zipped through it so fast. Could you tell me again what all the issues are that you want to eventually get into the e-permitting realm?
If I may, Chair Gomber, Senator Johnson, let me take a crack at the highest level, and if I don't get where you want to get, we'll call Mark in to get into some more detail.
Sure.
In terms of expanding e-permitting, there are really two ways of looking at that, and so I want to make sure I'm heading down the right direction that you are. When we originally conceived of the effort in 2007, we assumed it was a 10-year effort to get 90 jurisdictions on the system. We signed the contract, I happen to remember vividly, on August 8th of 2008. 8808, which was just as we were in free fall off the cliff into the recession. And so that 10-year plan, if expanding the system is in reference to the number of jurisdictions, our plan is still roughly 90 jurisdictions on the system. That 10-year plan from 2008 now looks more like about a 15-year plan to allow for that lack of progress we were able to make in those 4 or 5 years from 2008. The other way of looking at expansion is in terms of the types of services that can be accomplished on the system, and land use is the main element of expansion. And what we find is that most jurisdictions that already have some kind of an electronic system for managing their permit business or that envision implementing one want to be able to manage your conditional use permit at the same time and on the same system that they're managing your electrical permit or your structural permit or your permits for curb cuts or all those sorts of things. And so it's really that that set of construction-related permits that are not literally out of the permits out of the building code that we want the system to be able to deal with, so that we're not in a position of telling a jurisdiction, well, we'll give you this half of the whole that you need to manage your business, but you got to buy the other half on your own or from a different vendor or something like that. And so that's the expansion we're talking about in that context. Is that helpful?
Yes, it is. But Mr. Chair, if you just give me a little latitude. So you had talked about planning. Originally, when I thought this was conceived, it was to be able to get, as Mr. Long described yesterday, instantaneous go, no-go decisions on permits where all of the stars lined up. And as I recalled, and I'm doing some of this from memory, there was a 4% surcharge on each building permit issued. Is that
correct?
So my question now is, as the portal expands and you get into different activities, and you've just mentioned one that I happen to know well. I was in a conditional use debate that lasted 2 decades and delivered a record that is probably as tall as 2 basketball players. Is that 4% surcharge going to attach to each one of those elements that you're now adding?
Yeah, Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, the surcharge structure remains essentially the same. In fact, if anything, it gets scaled back. The statute provides for us to charge up to a 5% surcharge, and we have chosen to charge 4. The bill actually changes the statutory limitation to 4 and doesn't change the scope of what the surcharge covers. So a local jurisdiction will obviously continue to charge the fees it charges for its land use activities, but the surcharge would not reach over and attach to those land use activities. It would continue to be funded out of the surcharge on the direct construction permits.
Okay, because I guess what finally got to me, I was thinking about a bill that we've already passed on the Senate side, Senate Bill 133. Mm-hmm. And that's some policy changes. We're having a budget discussion here, and I didn't know where those budget issues and policy issues, especially policy as it affects financial activities of the agency, I didn't know where that conversation linked up. And mostly what I was trying to find out was with this, I think, welcome expansion of the e-permitting process, if all of those other activities were going to have the 4% attached to it. And I think I have just heard you say no.
That's correct. Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, I think the answer to your question is by continuing the surcharge as it exists in its current form without creating a change in the underlying fiscal structure of the system, the statute allows us added policy latitude to expand the breadth of service, which will ensure expanding into more jurisdictions, but without making a change in the fiscal structure of the program.
Okay, I may reserve the right to come back and talk about that again. I want to make absolutely sure I understood you. One other question I guess I have is, not every jurisdiction participates in e-permitting, right?
Correct.
It's by choice, and if the convenience of the system serves your purposes, then it's a good deal for you. But if I go to the counter in Columbia County and get a building permit, the 4% is assessed there?
That's correct. Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, at the creation of the system in 2007, the bargain that was struck amongst the various stakeholders of the system was the surcharge needed to be broad across all permits to be able to support the expansion of this program, and with the intent that virtually all jurisdictions would come on the system, albeit voluntarily over time. And what that really creates, I guess, is a dynamic where you can have a jurisdiction that wants to go its own route on an electronic system, and that financial structure, we think, appropriately causes a local conversation about, is it appropriate to pay for a separate electronic system when the state system that's already being paid for by the stakeholders is available? And we've had that play out in a number of places over the time that we've been implementing this.
A couple more questions, and
please,
then I'll give it a rest. You just said that you're authorized to go up to 5%.
Current law.
But are you going to put 4% in statute?
Senate Bill 133 does that.
What about that percent you're leaving on the table if you are authorized to go to 5 now?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, that was a point of friction in 2007 when this originally passed. The original deal amongst stakeholders was at that 4% level. There was some overly eager caution about abundance of caution that caused the language up to 5 to get into the bill. It almost derailed the bill. We've never needed over the 4%. We have no expectation to need over the 4%. The stakeholders believe they have a deal at 4%, and so we're quite comfortable locking that into the statutory language, and it tracks with how we've been operating this since 2008.
Okay, one more, and then I'm done.
Very good.
I get the impression that the system works well now. But as you add all of these other functions to it, have you made sure that your core system is providing what locals need at the local level before you begin adding other elements to it?
Yeah, Senator Johnson, Chair Gomberg, our conscious strategy, and I happen to have been the person at Building Codes at the time who negotiated the contract for the service, was to use a commercial off-the-shelf system that is, in fact, the market leader in this space, and whose base product, in fact, already accommodates all of these functions and services, and in fact, conceivably more. And so we're not really talking about adding anything from a technology standpoint. We're talking about turning on access to already existing modules in the system.
Okay. Thank you for your latitude. And I apologize for having to dredge this all up again, but I was just, what I was really wondering was whether or not this was now going to be a 4% surcharge added to a whole plethora of undefined activities, and the 4% would just keep rolling in with no legislative oversight because we will have embedded it in statute with Senate Bill 133. And I was just trying to figure out, once the spigot was turned on, who was going to oversee the revenue? What were you going to do with it?
Right. I totally understand.
Okay, thanks.
Great.
I'm sorry, Representative Wilson.
I just wanted to follow up, as long as we're dredging up, for those in TV land. Yesterday I asked a question about, is a permit required to change out a water heater? And thank you, Mr. Long, very much. He provided me with a letter that, much to my shock and awe, tells me that in Klamath County, the county would charge $211 for a permit to change out the water heater for the basically looking at it, you know, to have someone come and make sure that you as a consumer did this properly if you did it yourself. And so it depends on where you're at in the state, as he was saying, but I thank you for getting this to me because I had no idea that you could pay $200 for, and this is a county, this is Klamath County, to replace your own water heater, excluding the cost of the water heater, just for someone to come look at it. At the letter.
And Senator Johnson.
It begs the question. The water heater blows up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I got to go get a new water heater. I install it without a permit to keep my basement from flooding. Who busts me?
Senator Johnson, Mark Long for the record. As a homeowner, you're probably in pretty good shape. A lot of this system is designed on the contractor to make sure there's a uniform business regulatory environment. And what I was trying to illustrate yesterday was those individual permit costs are what they are, and the minor label program if I recall, you buy 10 permits for $140, allows that contractor a lot of flexibility that doesn't exist in the old system. And we're kind of proud of that idea of creating this package of 10 labels. You buy in advance, you can use anywhere, they're a lot cheaper, and you can get your work done as a contractor.
So
as a homeowner, it's
a subdivision. I would have all my permits for the 10 houses in the subdivision.
That's correct, and you could even buy more than 10 if you wanted to.
Cool. Okay.
All right. And with that epilogue, we'll move along to our regularly scheduled presentations today.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. We left yesterday with two elements of homework, one from Representative Whitsitt, I think we indicated at the time, was a bit comprehensive and would take longer than today. It turns out that Senator Johnson's question having to do with the all-in cost of the mediation program at the Workers' Compensation Board also requires a bit more work than we had anticipated, and so we're not prepared with that answer today. We would anticipate being able to deliver both sets of answers sometime next week, if that's amenable to the committee.
Please.
Fine with you.
All right, with that then, I'd like to turn to the health insurance marketplace that we'd like to spend a bit of time on. I'm joined today by Barry Leslie, who as of a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago now, I have appointed as the permanent administrator of the health insurance marketplace. Some of you may remember Ms. Leslie from her time spent on special assignment from our agency on loan to the Construction Contractors Board to execute a bit of a turnaround there, as she is incredibly well qualified for this work, and she especially is here to keep me from saying anything wrong and answering the any difficult questions. I'll tackle the easy ones. But we'd like to take a quick couple of minutes to talk about the health insurance marketplace. As we said at the outset of our presentation, all of the budget discussion you've seen so far, and particularly numbers, are from the governor's recommended budget, which does not include the effects of Senate Bill 1, which is transferring the marketplace from Cover Oregon to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So this is the delta that you'll see today that represents those impacts. Just for review, Senate Bill 1 passed and was signed by the governor, I believe, on March 6th. It winds down Cover Oregon as an organization on signing. It ended the terms of service of the board of directors, and the executive director invested those authorities in me. But the organization continues to exist until June 30th, and so I'm the CEO of both DCBS and Cover Oregon for that period of time. It establishes an advisory committee broadly patterned after the Management Labor Advisory Committee and Workers' Compensation, the idea being that there is a broad stakeholder forum where advice can be generated and complicated issues can be dealt with, particularly as a public body in the light of day, so that we're trying to maintain transparency on those kinds of issues. The bill finally and fully becomes effective on June 30th of 2015. So right now we're in the transition phase of implementing the bill. This is a process that we began informally in the fall and moved semi-formally to in December prior to the bill actually passing, but as it became clear that was a likely direction that you collectively were going to go. And then on bill passage, we're now fully implementing that transition plan. The idea is to make sure that we're able to seamlessly transition the services that are going on at Cover Oregon without impact on Oregonians. And I should pause here and talk about what that really means. As we discussed a day or two ago, once upon a time, Cover Oregon was an animal that was really about technology acquisition and taking processes in multiple agencies and consolidating them in a single agency and creating a technology platform to do that. The Cover Oregon functions that we're inheriting are substantially less than that at this point. As you probably know, Oregon is using the federal technology platform for eligibility enrollments, the Oregon Health Authority is pursuing transition to the Kentucky platform for eligibility and enrollments in the Medicaid system. And so what we're really left with are the policy decisions, the control of the system, the responsibility for making arrangements for a platform, whether it's with the federal government or anyone else, and all of the functions that constitute being a state-based marketplace. It's very important that Oregon maintain its status as a state-based marketplace. There's a case before the Supreme Court today that you've probably heard of, King versus Burwell, that has to do with the status of tax credits if you are on a federal marketplace. And so we've been careful both in the construction of Senate Bill 1 and in the subsequent operation of the transition in the program to be very careful to articulate that we are operating a state-based marketplace and have chosen to use the federal platform. Cover Oregon, as an organization, has a body of work that it is winding down right now. Largely, this relates to the 2014 open enrollment year that they were responsible for. That year is actually, in many respects, still ongoing. Throughout calendar 2014, people were able to report life changes and make additions to or obtain coverage through Cover Oregon. They were actually able to report those life changes through March 31st. So as of just a couple of days ago, it was possible for someone to come into Cover Oregon and buy coverage for the 2014 calendar year. We're now in tax season, and Cover Oregon is responsible for the 1095A reporting forms for that single year. Going forward, we will no longer be responsible for that. Those will be federal responsibilities or the responsibility of whoever those platform services come from. But that body of work continues, and our aim is to wind that down by June 30th. The sort of large-scale next steps are to establish the advisory committee that I referred to, develop a plan for the small business marketplace that's required under federal law, to begin to plan for 2016 open enrollment, which is a process that actually kicks off in fall of 2015, and then develop a communications and marketing plan to effectively get folks enrolled in insurance. I've described the system as sort of a perpetual motion machine where there's something important happening pretty much all the time, so there's not a peak and a lull in the work, and we can use the lull as a place to do a cold stop and a cold start. We're going to need to stand up our functions at DCBS at the same time Cover Oregon is standing down.
Excuse me. Yes, Senator Johnson?
Mr. Allen, the next steps, establish an advisory committee. Talk about that a little bit, because there's an old axiom, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. I mean, who's on that advisory committee is going to matter a lot. Who's the appointing authority? Will it be qualifications-based? How are you going to...
Yeah, Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, I mentioned that the committee is broadly patterned after the Management Labor Advisory Committee and Workers' Compensation, and so the structure looks somewhat similar. There are a number of designated stakeholder slots, so providers, insurers, people who've purchased their insurance through the marketplace, and so on. The positions are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, similar to MLAC. They are advisory to me. I continue to maintain as is the case with MLAG, I maintain the decision-making authority for the for all of the elements of the marketplace. But that's the broad structure.
And is it a follow-up? Is it a permanent standing group?
It's a statutory committee. We'll begin the recruiting process shortly after session with an aim toward proposing nominees in the September confirmation window.
Cool. Thank you.
So a bit about the finances of Cover Oregon, and here I want to correct the record a bit. Representative Nierman and I had an exchange, I think, on the first day, and somehow between the two of us, we got hooked on a number of $60 million, which I think was a number that came from a different presentation on a somewhat different topic. $45 million is the actual total fiscal impact of Senate Bill 1. The nature of our conversation was accurate. I talked about pass-through dollars and the resulting program being about $25 million, and that remains the same. It's the amount of the pass-through that is smaller than what we talked about. But you see on the left-hand side of this chart that $23 million of that total is this pass-through from the health authority, which is to pay for its share of the system. That's a combination of licenses, services, and other charges related to the partially delivered and reasonably semi-functional system that Cover Oregon and the health authority use to manage their books of business. From a staffing standpoint, you see at the bottom, we intend to hire 15 permanent positions. We also have 16 limited duration one-year positions. Three of these are in IT. That's basically bringing over existing Cover Oregon IT staff who are the most familiar and most able to help us with the transition of their technology into our system, as well as the 13 people who are in the call center. Those folks are important to bring over as existing Cover Oregon employees because, A, they can use the Oracle system that they need to be able to answer those kinds of calls for clarification about 1095s or whatever else they might be dealing with, and are subject matter experts in the time period that we need to do that work. It would be virtually impossible for us to hire people fresh off the street and train them to that level. Though those call center positions are limited duration positions, because although we're required to operate a call center going forward, it's impossible for us to tell today what the nature and scope of that call center looks like a year from now. And so it would be really impossible for us to appropriately scale the staffing level that would need to be there. You would expect that we would come back with some kind of a budget adjustment in the future with a better understanding once we have gotten to that level of work to talk about permanent call center staff.
Senator.
How will you maintain a bench for the call center? And by that, I mean, we have seen instances where you have folks that retire en masse out of an agency and nobody knows how to do the work. You're talking about kind of specialized work here in terms of the body of knowledge that the call center responders need to have, their experience in dealing with customers. How do you intend to maintain an adequate reserve of folks to be able to put into those slots so you don't have any gaps in service?
Sure. Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, thank you for the question. I think a couple of things.
You identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Barry Leslie. I am the new administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Welcome, Ms. Leslie.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your very recent appointment.
Thank you very much. So a couple of things I think we intend to do because of the uncertainty of what the call volume will look like in the future. First of all, their expertise is particularly helpful as we resolve some of the 2014 issues. So up front, that expertise is just hugely important. And that's not to say that the expertise necessarily doesn't continue, but it becomes more generic from the standpoint of helping people be guided to the federal system and helping them know more of a resource and referral. So that specialization will get smaller and smaller as we near the November 1st open enrollment window. But having said that, I think it's the same way we would approach any just kind of good government model of making sure we have staff trained and ready to do the work, and that is you document your processes really well, you have really consistent processes, you evaluate the work, and then also try to just strategize departures and retirements and also be constantly grooming and preparing people to take those positions next.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Whitsitt.
How many people are now in Oregon's health insurance plan? Is it 900 and some thousand? I mean, that are covered by?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, I think the effectuated rate for the 2015 open enrollment is up to a little more than 85,000.
85,000.
But from the number that you used in asking the question, I suspect you may be conflating the private health insurance with the Oregon Health Plan.
Right. Oh. I'm sorry. Yes.
And I don't have the Oregon Health Plan number in my pocket.
I believe it's 1.2 million, but that is just a really well-educated guess.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Please continue.
So what you see here is when we peel back out the flow through dollars from the health authority, what really is the actual core operating expenditures and revenue for the marketplace. I want to draw your attention to a couple of things. We will inherit a beginning balance from CoverOregon of about $8 million, which provides available funds of $29 million against expenditures of $22 million. We do anticipate spending in the first biennium a bit more than the revenue the system will generate. That's one-time and short-term costs that go into the winding down of the existing CoverOregon system. We anticipate those will go away over time, and our long-term projections are that we're able to make the system financially sustainable within the existing assessment of about $9.66 per member per month, but certainly within the statutory limit of 3.5% of premiums, and that obviously is our goal, is to make this system work within the resources that we have and not need to come back and have a conversation about added resources. Let me wrap up this portion talking about risks. Certainly, as you are all well aware, we could probably go on at great length about risks. But again, I want to draw your attention to the fact that this is no longer a technology development or operation project. There are elements of work that we'll have to do going forward that result from that technology project. But we're not out designing systems. We're not out with substantial contractors for platforms. We are going to have a platform conversation about the shop, the small business marketplace, but in my wildest dreams, I could not imagine coming back here and asking you for permission to go hire someone to develop a purpose-built IT platform for us to do that function. And so the nature of what this animal is different than what it was 2 years ago. As I mentioned, it's a perpetual motion machine. The timelines are tight, and that's going to be, at any point that we're trying to do something meaningful, there's going to be something equally meaningful going on. And so the opportunities for those kinds of issues are there. We're concerned always about scope creep, trying to add more functions or more issues to the plate, and we're historically pretty good at defending about that. We've already touched on loss of knowledge and resources. CoverOregon today is down to about 100 employees. Their own internal plan was to be down to about 41 employees by the end of June, given that we're only hiring 15 permanent positions, you can see that under the most optimistic scenario, most CoverOregon employees will be doing other things after June 30th, and so we need to aggressively work to manage knowledge transfer in that environment.
Senator Johnson.
I don't want to stray into too descriptive a question about personnel, but I don't know whether or not two very useful personnel will be transferring over to your shop. I'm not going to name them on the record, but they have been incredibly useful liaisons between the legislature and constituents who have been trying to navigate this system. And I just didn't know whether or not they would be coming. And Ms. Berry is nodding as though she knows exactly who I'm talking about. The institutional knowledge invested in those two people is huge.
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, I believe you're talking about a couple of staff who are coming over as part of the call center, because I've heard wonderful things about them. So, yes, they are coming over, and we're looking forward to working with them.
Thank you.
With that, are there any questions before we wrap up the overall presentation about the exchange?
Questions? Looks like we don't have any questions.
In that case, that concludes the prepared presentation we have on the department budget. I'd be happy to answer overall questions you have. I just do want to say that every day I get to go to work with 900 incredibly talented, incredibly dedicated public servants in the truest sense of the word, who spend every day trying to figure out how to do their jobs in ways that make Oregon a better place. I've had the privilege in the last month of adding another 100 people at Cover Oregon who have exhibited a degree of professionalism in the face of their organization literally being terminated largely due to things that didn't have to do at all with the work that they do. And so on behalf of all of them, I thank you for the opportunity for us to talk about how we do our work, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Representative Whitson.
Just so I understand, we're still calling it Cover Oregon. Is that right?
Well, it's Cover Oregon, Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitson. Cover Oregon exists until June 30th. After June 30th, on the Department of Consumer and Business Services org chart, you will see a box for Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. And so Cover Oregon as a brand will go away at that point.
But we still have it now. That's why we're calling that, even though we passed a bill to... Okay.
Right.
Thank you. That's why I was a little mixed up in what I was asking you, because I thought we didn't...
Understood.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. Director Allen, I appreciate your comments about your 900 colleagues. I feel exactly the same about the 90 that I work with here. I'm going to invite you to hold on for a few minutes, and we're going to turn to Mr. Ball, who's been very patient with us this week. And I'll invite you to introduce yourself for the committee, and we can move into your part of the presentation.
I'm going to switch chairs here real quick. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, Dustin Ball at the Chief Financial Office. I'm going to get this. Here we go. Over the past 3 days, the agency has walked through the divisions in detail and talked about the programs. What I have for you today is a presentation that will give you a high-level overview of the agency's budget for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And as I walk through the slides, please feel free to stop me if you have any questions, and I'll try to address those as we go. In developing the governor's budget for the agency, the emerging issues that we looked at were the economic recovery in Oregon and how that's driving the demand for services on the agencies, the ability to support the existing programs, and efforts for financial reform. Also, we looked at the Oregon's 10-year plan for and how the agency played into particularly the public safety outcome area. This slide is going to give you a high-level overview of the agency's budget over the past several biennia. On the far left is the actuals from the 11-13 biennium, and moving to the right is the governor's budget. As you'll note, as Mr. Allen talked about earlier on Tuesday, this is a fairly flat budget for the agency. There's a little bit of growth in the FTE, and we'll walk through those with the individual packages included in the budget. What I want to call out in this slide is, if you look at the overall agency budget, it is approximately $426 million. Of that, only 54% of the budget, about $228 million, is the actual operations of the agency. The remainder is in non-limited funds, which is the Workers' Benefit Fund and other reserve accounts. Revenues for the operation of the agency come from three main sources, and that is the business licenses and fees, That makes up approximately 54% of the age, or excuse me, 35% of the agency's budget. Federal funds are approximately 7%, and the workers' compensation assessments make up about 54%. The investments included in the governor's budget, I'm going to walk through these by the divisions the same way that the agency walked through their budget. When we look at the workers' compensation division, we have one package that adds one position, which will address workload increases related to disability award disputes. In OSHA, we have one package to add four positions to restore program capacity to conduct safety enforcement visits, field consultations, and streamline program rules. In the insurance division, we have two packages. One makes permanent a limited duration position to assist in the management of caseload. This position was originally established in May 2014 eBoard. The second position in the insurance division adds two positions to enhance the oversight of insurance products and market regulation. The buildings code division has one package that will make permanent four limited duration positions to allow the division to respond timely to the increasing demands of its customers. This also was originally established in the May 2014 eBoard, and this package just makes those positions permanent. And then there are, in the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, there's three packages, and each of these have their own separate legislation. One is related to Senate Bill 274 to address the challenges associated with regulating debt collectors. Another is Senate Bill 275, which would require loan servicers to be licensed by the agency. And the last is Senate Bill 276, which establishes licensing for buy here, pay here used auto dealers. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ball. Thank you for being with us this week. I'm going to turn to the public testimony portion of the hearing today. I have five people signed up. And why don't I start with Mr. Fuller and Mr. Powell? Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Again. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I'm here before you today as a stakeholder who represents insurance companies primarily in working with DCBS. And until recently, all lines, but fortunately, I'm no longer representing a health insurer, which has made my life much simpler for the last few months. And my heart goes out to Barry Leslie and her new role. I just want to say that in any organization, the leadership usually tells you a lot about what's underneath and where the rubber meets the road. And I have to say, and I get nothing out of Pat Allen, so I'm just saying this from my heart, he's a gem as an administrator. And I think his best attribute is the ability to spot talent. And I've watched him since he took over, and the talent he has put into different positions is clearly in a league of its own, and that agency from the people I deal with has steadily improved in its services. And the people that work there treat everybody that comes there with respect. I lose a majority of the things I go there for, or compromise substantially. And it's because they have a role of putting pressure on my clients, and they do that, and they do that well. What I wish we could film from time to time is when a company is called in and asked why the following claims have been handled the way they've been handled. Not necessarily somebody complaining, but they've been able to discern a pattern, and they call them in, and they demand answers to those. The public doesn't see that. And, of course, my client doesn't want it on the front page either. So we don't advertise it. But and sometimes there's just rational answers for why it happened, and sometimes the data is just wrong. But the demand is there. People don't realize in the insurance field, their rates and forms division has to review all the, every word that's sold in an insurance policy prior to it being sold, and people take that for granted. It's a hard job, and they get a ton of filings. And there's competition in these fields for annuities and other products that, again, take a lot of work on the part of that agency. And sometimes my clients think they're too slow, and they want things to happen faster. But they're very, very thorough, and they, again, they demand precision in those filings. So when you look at the dollar figures that you see there, it and then the fact that it's not going like this, they're going to keep working hard, and they do work hard. And so I'm just simply here to say that as a consumer and as a stakeholder in that agency, I think they do yeoman's work, I hope that their budget is approved as close to what they're proposing as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Any questions? Well, welcome, Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Darrell Fuller. I am here this afternoon. I have been deputized, certified, pasteurized, and homogenized to represent 9 different organizations here today in an effort to streamline the public testimony as it regards the Building Codes Division portion of the DCBS budget. I'm happy to give you the list of all 9 organizations if you want it for the record, but just know that we use almost all letters of the alphabet except, I think, for X and Z, and we use A, C, and O several times. So we, I'm here on behalf of both union and open shop contractors and a number of union organizations, and we support the building codes portion of the budget and the policy option package number 8, which was discussed a little bit earlier. In the 2011 legislative session, building codes division lost 33 positions. And since then, through 2014, construction permits sales has increased 13%. Now, if you take 13% of 33 lost positions, you get 4.25 positions to keep up with the Joneses. The policy option package number 108 makes permanent the 4 temporary positions that you guys approved through the emergency board. So if anything, the policy option package number 108 might be light for what they actually need to keep up with the increasing demand on their work by the contracting industry. But we support the packages they have it introduced. Their job is twofold, and both portions of the job they have is very significant. The most important job they have is to protect the safety and health and welfare of Oregonians by making sure that contractors follow the law, that the water is clean, that the building won't fall down, that the electricity is not going to catch on fire. They have a very, very significant role in making sure that everybody is protected. The other half of that role is that when a contractor needs to have a government employee come and approve something, they need to have somebody who's available and can show up to the site and approve or not approve the process as it is without delay. There's nothing more frustrating for a contractor or for the person who has hired the contractor to get work done to sit and wait because there isn't an inspector that's available to come and do the inspection. And as you probably know, the construction industry sort of waxes and wanes with the economy, and so it's a very difficult job for them to have the right number of people on the job so that they don't have people with nothing to do during the bad times, but they've got plenty of people that are available when we're busy. It is our hope that we're going to get more and more busy as we start to recover from this sluggish economy. And when our guys are ready for inspections, we want, whether it's a city, whether it's a county, or whether it's a state inspector, we want somebody there. It's also important to the contractor community that those inspectors be extremely knowledgeable. The notion of temporarily hiring somebody and then laying them off and temporarily hiring somebody else does not work well when they're in a position of determining whether or not something moves forward because they've met a code. We want the best and the brightest in those positions. And the goal, and I think Building Codes Division, working with their partners at the cities and the counties, do a very good job, is that we could pluck an inspector from anywhere in the state and put them on a project anywhere in the state, and they would review it, and they would reach the same conclusion as any other inspector because they're all working off the same code. They all use the same depth and experience, and that we have a level playing field when it comes to inspecting as we move things forward. So we support the policy option package number 8. We support the bill as it's written. We appreciate the hard work that the Building Codes Division and all of their people there do to be responsive not only to the contracting industry but to the consumers who ultimately have work projects that are getting done. We think they do a good job of providing good customer service. They're sensitive to the industries that they regulate, and they're also interested in making sure that construction programs move along as quickly as possible. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes, Senator Johnson.
I don't know, Mr. Fuller, whether you're the right person to pose this question to, but let me give it a try.
Pretty sure I'm not, but go ahead.
I have had a constituent issue where a constituent wanted to avail themselves of some of these energy modernization programs and went to one of the programs, one that this legislature funded, and alleges that the work was done very, very badly. I initially turned to CCB to see about getting redress for the poorly performed construction work, and with Mr. Denno at CCB's help, exhausted what CCB could do. In terms of building codes, you made a particular point of saying that there's a lot of consumer protection there, and I guess the question that I'm asking is, for some of these energy efficiency groups that are springing up all over the place, some of them with public money, are inspectors required at that low a subset for performing that kind of work, or are we mostly, for your clients, talking about big inspections like electrical for a new building or elevators?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I think you were probably correct at the beginning that I'm the wrong person to ask that question. I had meant to say at the beginning of my testimony that one of my goals today was that you not go home and mull over my testimony at all so that I don't have to come back.
I'll mull over my question with Mr. Long then. He's giving me the little hand signals. He knows.
I suspect that, as I said, we were talking about water heaters. You guys were talking about water heaters a little earlier. There are incentive programs with hot water heaters, and obviously even if you do that yourself, you have to have an inspection. So if it is an inspection-related issue, then there had to have been an inspector that inspected that shoddy work, and I would think that would be the person you go to. What level of program your constituent was in, I don't know, so I don't know whether that's something that would be inspected or not.
I'll take it offline. So thank you.
I apologize. Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ms. Sundstrom and Mr. Holston. And friends.
In an effort to expedite testimony, my colleague over here asked me to start out with, so I'll do that. My name's Chair, members of the committee, my name's Lon Holston. I'm here to testify today in favor of DCBS's budget, and I thank you for allowing me to testify today. I kind of come from a unique standpoint in the sense that I've had a lot of interaction throughout DCBS in a lot of different divisions with them. I spent some quality time on MLAC and spent years there in an advisory role to the legislature on workers' compensation issues. I was also co-chair at one time along with my colleague Sherry here. And we worked our way through some very difficult bills and processes to be able to come to a good product to bring back to the legislature. I've also been and currently sitting on MAC, which is the Medical Advisory Committee. And MAC is another advisory committee that advises the department and the legislature on medical issues. And they spend copious amounts of time, both of those two organizations, studying workers' comp, the medical delivery systems, and making recommendations like for pain management and opioid guidelines for physicians to help them manage their patients and injured workers. And that was a big important piece because there was all kinds of discussions around opioid prescriptions, how they were getting out in the field. The feds were having their problems with it. And this helped actually give guidelines to physicians that they could follow and some advice from their colleagues to be able to help them manage that problem. We also studied the 6-AMA guide. We've studied the BIOM ankle prosthetic. We've done things with cervical lumbar artificial discs as we study those issues on whether they're compensable or non-compensable. So I can tell you that in that process, I learned that we could not function on those committees without really good data and information. And we got that data and information from a lot of different sources. We got it from OSHA. We got it from the Ombudsman for Injured Workers. We got it out of the department. We got it out of the information department also for WCD. We also got it from Croat and Ken Anger, who is up at OHSU, who studies, and their group up there studies workplace safety involving chemicals and other issues that were in the workplace. At one point, when I was in Medford working for Medite Corporation, we had a problem down there with some isocyanate, and the staff down there and the workers were down there were pretty much stumped on the problems that they were having with this particular chemical process. And it was brought up to Mr. Anger and his group, and they were able to help advise that employer on what they needed to do to find the fix to prevent the problems that they were having with that particular product. So I can tell you, I'm not going to read my testimony. I can tell you that the quality of folks that I've dealt with at DCBS has been top-notch. They're journeymen through and through. They've been able to help us in many different ways in our roles and functions on MLAC and MAC. I've also had a lot of serious involvement with the insurance division. I'm a licensed insurance producer. I've had a lot of questions revolving different products, how they act within the workplace, because I negotiate contracts. And so for me to be able to negotiate contracts with the employers, that information that I was able to receive out of the insurance division on the products that were out there was a lot of help. So I can tell you that through and through, from my dealings within OSHA, whether it's PROAT, whether it's the Ombudsman's Office, has been top-notch, as well as with WCD. So with that, I would like to thank you again for allowing me to testify. And I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions?
No, I have a question.
Please.
Since I'm new on this committee, I was wondering what you mean by certain artificial parts to your body are compensable with limitations. What do you mean by that? I mean,
well, these are complicated issues, and you sit with physicians on this panel who have more technical skill than I do as a worker, but we've discussed whether or not it's helpful, whether it's not helpful, duration of treatment, how they install, how they monitor, how they take care of the pain, and how they deal with all the issues that are involved with this type of medical procedure. So there's some things that are medically practical that they say, yeah, this is a good thing, we think we should allow this. But there's other components that they're saying is not compensable, and so that the employer and the insurance shouldn't have to pay for it. So they do put certain limitations from time to time on certain treatment and procedures that they deal are either experimental or other things that they feel may not be quite so helpful. But then again, they'll make recommendations on things that are helpful. We're going back and restudying that issue. We usually do a roundtable of some issues that are like, we approve them for a couple of years, and then we go back and revisit it. And we revisit it to make sure that it's working as prescribed, so to speak, because we don't want to sit there and have something that is overused, that's not working with the technology the way it rolls out.
So, follow up.
So if someone has a workman's compensation claim and they need surgical procedure, you're saying that this group that you work with here, the workman's comp, decides what a person can and can't have?
Or, no.
Okay.
Representative, was that what happens is the doctor, the treating doctor, actually runs out the treatment plan. There's things that are compensable and there's things that are not compensable. The doctors usually have a pretty good handle on how they want to treat that patient, so they actually do all the ordering and they have a grocery list of options that they can employ while they're treating that worker that are compensable. That doesn't mean that they couldn't order something else that's not compensable. That's solely between the doctor and the patient. So I don't mean to say that this group makes those decisions. They just make decisions that are based on good scientific evidence and medical knowledge coming out of the committee on whether it should be compensable or whether it shouldn't.
So follow up. So the person's private insurance might pick up part of it, and then workman's comp, that's what you're talking about, the part that they would pick up then?
Well, my experience is that if you have an accepted claim, it's covered all on the accepted side. Once the claim is over with, at that point, there is a certain conditions that are either accepted or not accepted, of course, in a workers' compensation claim. And how that works out in the end is usually between the attorney and the injured worker, because they're probably looking for a compensability hearing. And how it goes from there, I can't really tell you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Holston. Ms. Sunstrom, or whoever's next.
That's fine. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sherry Sunstrom, and I work for Hoffman Construction. And I, too, am here in support of DCBS's budget. And I'm going to speak not to building codes, but to the WCD, the Workers' Comp Division. And by way of just an explanation, My background is that I am the claims manager for Hoffman Construction. I get the pleasure of taking care of all of our injured workers, injured not only in Oregon, but in all states we do business. I also sat on the MLAC committee for approximately 12 years. Six of those I was the management co-chair. And I'm currently sitting on the version of that for the state of Washington. So I want to give you kind of an idea of what I access through WCD and my ongoing relationship with WCD and how helpful they are to me in my day-to-day job as well as my other volunteer efforts that I do in other states. So as you can imagine, Hoffman Construction, we're a general contractor. We do a business in several states. I routinely am accessing information from WCD as I'm investigating other states for their rules and laws in the area of workers' comp. And hands down, the Workers' Comp Division for the state of Oregon has the best website and the best management team in all the states that Hoffman Construction does business. So very, very helpful there. One of the things I use daily practically in the state of Oregon is the proof of coverage, so we make sure all of our contractors on the site have workers' comp coverage for their covered workers on the job site. I participate. The department is very good about being inclusive in their rulemaking for any of the laws that you all pass. They invite a large sweep of interested folks to sit in on those meetings with a wide variety of backgrounds, and whether it be representing workers or representing management, that sit in on those rulemaking advisory meetings. And I do think that we do a very good job in the state of Oregon of being able to have rules that are clear and have a lot of thought and intention put into them. I also have to give them credit for their information that's on their website for injured workers. It's very easy to direct an injured worker to the website if they aren't 100% sure of what I'm saying, so they can get clarification if they need it. Some of the things that I use outside of the state of Oregon are claims costs, statistical information specific to various types of injuries, and also I use different industries as well, just as kind of a pulse point. And again, Oregon is known nationwide as one of the best states for their information through the Workers' Comp Division. The WCD personnel is always, always very responsive to any requests. I ask them questions. Not only, I try to do, especially for the WCAC, the Workers' Comp Advisory Committee in the state of Washington, as I've gotten more entrenched with that. And one of the reasons I was chosen was because of my tenure on the MLAC in Oregon, and they love everything we do in Oregon. So I'm able to share information from the Workers' Comp Division in Oregon, specifically anything to do like with our return to work programs that are so successful and also nationally recognized, and many, many other things. The department is open to comments and criticism, and they will investigate if we have any concerns about anything that that we see in our workers' comp community on the management side that may be problematic for everybody as a whole. And they're also, again, they're open to sharing their stories with other states. I recently asked the Ombudsman of Oregon if she would be willing to talk to the new ombudsman that has been recently put into the state of Washington. And just hands down, if whatever they can do to help out, if they can do it, they will. And speaking of the ombudsman, I want you all to know that is a treasure trove for the state of Oregon for injured workers. That office provides so much support for our injured workers, and it's so easy to be able to, refer a worker to the ombudsman. You know that the worker's going to get their questions answered, and if there's a pattern or a behavior by an employer or an insurance company, they are going to notch it up and help to figure out what that issue is, so other workers don't have those same issues. And I wish they would add more people to that department personally, because I think it is a very good department for the state of Oregon. So our experience, Hoffman Construction's experience with Oregon, is hands down meets and exceeds our expectation against any other state in the United States. So thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Sundstrom. Any questions? Yes.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, and I'm here this afternoon to testify in favor of the DCBS budget and specifically the Workers' Compensation Division budget. I'm one of the volunteer members that forms the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. I've served there for 4 years. It's been a great learning experience. And it's made up of equal representatives from both management and labor, and we do our very best to try and find the middle to ensure that when workers are injured, they receive the very best benefits that we can possibly provide them, that they receive the treatments that they need so they can go back to work as soon as they possibly can. And yet we still want to be very mindful of the rates that employers pay so that they're affordable, and that's a part of their business component that we try and be very respectful of. Ms. Sundstrom spoke to the workers' comp ombudsman for injured workers, and they do a great job and have helped a great number of our members. Excuse me. There's also an ombudsman for small businesses. So if small businesses have questions, they have an ombudsman, a person that they can go to and talk to and try and get their questions answered. Obviously, the number one goal is to not have anybody injured at work. And unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. But we work very hard, like I said, to try and get them back to work. And that's the goal, both from the workers' perspective and from the employers' perspective. If any of you have been listening to the series on NPR over the last week or so that's been studying workers' compensation systems around the United States, I think all of us would realize how fortunate we are here in the state of Oregon. We're not perfect. We're always working to try and make it better. But there's a great number of states that their systems are frankly a mess, both from the perspective of very high rates for employers and very, very low rates. And in fact, some almost have systems in place that seems to just automatically deny workers benefits at all, which, you know, obviously from my perspective, I want workers treated with respect, but especially when an injured worker, they need to be treated with respect. So I think we're very fortunate here in Oregon, and the staff that helps us is top-notch. They give us great advice and counsel and are very responsive. And so I would just close my remarks there, and if anyone had any questions, I would do my very best to answer them. Thank you.
Questions at all? Mr. Mellis, we were talking earlier about the rate of claims and the fact that work and industry in Oregon have changed, and an economic downturn has also produced less construction. But construction is rebounding. Very positive news. Is it your sense that that our construction workplace in particular has become somewhat safer and that claims will continue to decline or at least stabilize even as the amount of work goes up? What's the situation out there?
Mr. Co-Chair, I definitely we're seeing an uptick in construction work, which is obviously very heartening. I started my apprenticeship 38 years ago, and the change in not only attitudes towards safety, but practices in safety is astonishing. I mean, it is a completely different world out there, which is really, really a good thing. Having said that, the one place where I think we would have to watch the rate and what that I know both employers and our unions are very mindful of is I think you'll see a higher incident of accidents amongst apprentices because they're new on the job, they don't know the ropes as much. And so that's another thing that you've seen over the last 5 or 10 years is a lot more intensive safety training early on for workers that are going on. And lots of times they'll be assigned to a specific journey level worker that mentors that person to make sure that they stay safe. But that's the one place that I would say we need to watch and that frankly already is being watched much closer. But just the whole culture, the attitude, the training has really changed. So I would hope that as the work increases, that you know, accidents would either you know stay where they're at or possibly even go down.
All right, very good. Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you all.
Thank you.
Ms. Butterfield, you've been very patient, and I'm sorry, did you want to come and join us as well?
I could.
Please. I was going to say, if anybody else has not had a chance to sign up and wanted to share a perspective with the committee, come on up and... Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I represent two insurance clients, American Family Insurance Company and the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho. That's a group of independent insurance agents that is statewide. Both clients want to support the insurance division's budget, and particularly let me speak on behalf of the agents. DCBS is a tough taskmaster. They have the ability to take away your license if you're an insurance agent, and they do that. Every month I get a report, an email report, saying they've taken away the license of XXX. And we think that's actually a good thing because there are 18,000, about 18,000 licensed in-state insurance agents, and not every one of them is a good apple. And so they keep our profession healthy by making sure that everybody is doing their job fairly and well. And we as insurance agents are the are the closest one in the insurance industry to the consumer. And we will often down here take the side of the consumer in insurance questions. And we know that the role that the insurance division has is very important for the consumer. So that's why we're here supporting their budget.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Please, welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson. My name is Paul Turdall, and I'm a resident of Northwest Portland, and I am also here in support of the DCBS budget. I'm a consumer. A couple of years ago, I worked on Senate Bill 365, which was a very comprehensive autism health insurance bill, and I have been working on as a volunteer, just insurance-related issues with the insurance division and consumers for about 4 years now, and have developed a very, very close, positive, and constructive working relationship throughout all levels of the insurance division and all departments on many of these issues. And it has been extremely helpful to have them to work with and understand these issues. I have, again, bear in mind, I'm just an ad hoc volunteer. I got started on this simply because I was having issues with my own children's insurance claims, and I was having success resolving those at the insurance divisions, and my friends started calling me, and their friends started calling me, and I think I'm around 140 different people have called me up over the years and asked for ideas on how to work these things through. And, you know, we have had some challenging cases where we had to go a litigation route, and I think there were three different class action suits that ended up getting filed out of the people who've come to me. But that's out of 140, and in a great many cases, the insurance division really did what they could to solve things. It's been a very thorny issue. It's been a challenging issue, extremely technical issue. But what I found from the very beginning in working with them is they wanted to help where they could. You know, where they could see there was clear legal support for what we were doing, you know, they did what we could to steer us in the right direction and say, okay, you can try this, you can try that. Where they found issues, it was very clear to them they had clear authority, they jumped in and helped. So I have personally never sued insurance companies over my kids' care, and my kids have been getting very good care from their and coverage from their insurance company for about 3.5 years now, thanks to help from the insurance division. In terms of the rulemaking process, I would say particularly Laura Cowley over the last couple of years has done an amazing job of bringing consumers into the process. I have been on rules advisory committees for several years, and a couple of years ago there'd be basically me and maybe one other consumer and 15 insurance company attorneys, you know, talking through things. More recently, I was on the Mental Health Parity Rules Advisory Committee, and there were 5 insurers, 5 providers, and 5 consumers from a variety of different backgrounds, and it was great. And it is just great the way that, you know, they have been able to sort of reach out to consumers and build those relationships and bring people into that process. And I'm very happy to, you know, to have the insurance division out there helping us with these things, and I really look forward to continuing working with them. So thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Any questions at all? Anybody else that wanted to share anything with us today? Anything from staff before I close this hearing? Nope. All right, I'm going to go ahead and conclude the hearing on 5012. Colleagues, we will be meeting on Monday. We will have a work session. I'm not sure how long the day is going to go. Co-Chair Johnson, did we have a grant proposal as well on Monday afternoon that we'll be voting on?
Mr. Chair, assuming that the big co-chair said yes.
Okay.
I don't know if that's been resolved
so
yet.
So we may have two votes, but we will have at least one vote on Monday. There is no committee meeting on Tuesday, although we may be having private or separate appointments. And then we'll be having a work session again on Wednesday. So anything else for the good of the order? Then we are adjourned. Good of the order?